flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Looking for a new home should be exciting, not frustrating. That's why Homes.com might just be the best home shopping site out there. Imagine searching for your dream home without ads cluttering your view. Homes.com's sleek, beautifully designed, ad-free interface makes your search simple and distraction-free. And if you're a parent, you know how important school information is. Homes.com gets it. They're the only site with detailed school and district info from multiple sources, including reviews from Niche. Plus, they've got a super comprehensive and transparent agent directory, making it easy to find the right expert to guide your journey. Oh, and here's a game changer. Homes.com always connects you directly with a listing agent who knows the home best. They even go beyond the basics, offering the most in-depth neighborhood content of any home shopping site, packed with details to help you find a community that feels like home. And the search tools? Unmatched. With 22 data visualization layers, 7 environmental layers, and filters for commute times and architectural styles, Homes.com truly is the home search you've been searching for. Go to Homes.com. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Jones and Keefe
on WEEI.
Download the Odyssey app and listen on demand anytime.
And the Celtics won't foul, and the Orlando Magic have done it. The short-handed young group knocks off the reigning champs.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's what the playoffs are. That's what it's about. And, you know, you have to be able to execute under those circumstances.
Welcome into Jones and Keefe, but it is not Jones and Keefe. I'm John Lyons alongside Dan Ball filling in for Jones and Keefe on Christmas Eve. Hope everyone is having a great holiday season. We have a lot to get to today. As you heard, the Celtics had arguably their most frustrating loss of the year to the Orlando Magic tonight, 108-104. While at the same time, the Bruins were having arguably their best win of the entire season over the Washington Capitals. We also have plenty of Patriots to get to, and because it's sports radio, maybe we'll be negative and tell you what we hate about the holidays. And we have Tier Tuesday. Tommy Curran is joining us at noon. So a lot to get to on this Christmas Eve fill-in edition of Jones and Keefe. Again, I'm John Lyons alongside Dan Ball. Dan. Busy day today. A lot to get to.
I know. Good morning, John. It's nice to see you again. I think there's a prerequisite that we can only work together if it's the day before or the day after a holiday. So it's nice to see you again.
That's true. So we did the day after Thanksgiving, yeah. AKA Black Friday show. Today we're the day before Christmas. You're actually on solo New Year's Day, so good for you.
Yeah,
so
maybe definitely like won't be nursing anything on New Year's Day
maybe
for,
the day
for
after
a couple hours.
Groundhog Day, we'll have a show together, right?
Yeah,
something
like that.
We'll keep track of that.
Okay.
Going forward, I do want to start Celtics here, though, Dan. And I know, again, this time of year, usually the Patriots are the big story, Red Sox offseason. We are going to get to all that. But you look at the Boston Celtics, they're 22-7. This loss last night, I mentioned, you know, probably their most frustrating loss of the year. And look, I'm a big Celtics fan, Dan. I know firsthand our green team of friends can get very defensive. So I want to state from the beginning, they're the best team in the NBA. I think they're going to win a championship. Doesn't mean last night's loss to a shorthanded Magic team, though, didn't cause some frustration.
No, I think that's fair, and it exposed something. There are so few holes that you can poke in this Celtics team. The one thing that I think it kind of exposed is, despite Orlando being shorthanded, when you don't have both Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown in the lineup, there's a significant difference in terms of the net rating and what they're able to generate, but they did not respond well to physicality yesterday. I love the note from John Corrales in the Boston Sports Journal this morning. Joe Mazzulla said the word physical in his post-game press conference 9 times, and Jaylen Brown said it 11 times. So it was parked in the brain of the Boston Celtics that Orlando brought a very physical style to the game yesterday. And you look up and down the roster, there's more talent on the Celtics, I'd say 1 through 7 in their rotation, than any team in the NBA right now. They don't necessarily have a player who you can turn to respond to the physicality. You look at the way Kristaps Porzingis is built, he looks like he'd respond to it, but he's made out of glass, so you're not going to necessarily have him drag you into the fight. I guess it would be Derek White, maybe Drew Holiday, but the Celtics are a very talented team, not a physical team, and I think that was your biggest issue last night.
And I think the thing about this, they're big, right? You look across, they had the double big lineup last night that worked, I thought, really well in the first half. They're big. They have a lot of size, and I think they can be physical when they're driving to the lane, but it's just, again, they're not accustomed to playing a physical game because they average 51 three-point attempts a game. Last night, they only shot 32, and I'm not one of those people that says, oh, they shoot way too many threes. I think on certain individual nights, like the Bulls loss, about a week ago or so?
Yeah.
That was a night maybe to shoot fewer threes because they were shooting so poorly. Maybe last night was a night to shoot fewer. But on the whole, I'm not one of those people. But I think the physicality point's interesting because I look at this Orlando team. That could be a first-round playoff matchup, maybe a second round. Like, this is a good Orlando team that, again, Mo Wagner's out for a while, but he'll be back by the playoffs. He didn't play last night. Paolo Banchero is, I think, one of the most underrated players in the NBA. But he also, obviously, he's been out for a while. He was out last night. He'll be back for the playoffs. So when the Celtics face this team in the playoffs, which I very well think they could, that's a style they're going to have to match up with. Now, look, I think they can, and I think they'll win that series. But last night was a nice reminder because let's not forget this Orlando team. Remember a couple of years ago when the Celtics went to the finals, Orlando beat them in a back-to-back in the regular season? Like, they've given last year on Black Friday, I think, was one of the worst Celtics losses of the year to Orlando.
Yeah.
So this Orlando team and their physicality, they have given the Celtics some problems this season, last season, the season before. So it was just interesting last night to see the Celtics shoot fewer threes, still only 25% from three.
Yeah.
But I felt maybe some inconsistent responses to the physicality you mentioned.
Yeah, and it especially kind of cropped up in the second half as it seemed like that style just started to wear them down just a little bit. And I think you did notice with no Jason Tatum, you know, just moments before tip-off, they were able to adjust off the tip and at least be able to score consistently. But then as the game went along, it did seem like the style kind of wore them down. I thought it was the defensive presence that Orlando was able to bring on the perimeter and force the Celtics inside, season lows in points, assists, three-point attempts, and three-point makes, and 19 turnovers, which was one shy of their season high.
Only 13 assists, too.
Right.
So not a great ratio.
which is one of the things that impresses me so much, and to your point about, oh, the Celtics take too many threes, they take a lot of threes, but they're also assisted on more than any other team in basketball because they move the ball around so well, and they really do have five guys on the floor that can beat you behind the arc. So I'm willing to chalk it up as a one-off because you were missing Tatum, but I do think that the overall thought of Orlando as a physical team, they're a team that can kind of ground and pound you and win a low-scoring game against you, it's something that should be in the back of your mind as you move through the Eastern Conference. Again, all this within the context of this was the first time all season the Celtics have lost 2 out of 3 games. That's bonkers to even say out loud. But I think there was a game planning element to this Orlando Magic team. That's something the Celtics would struggle with in a 7-game series. Not to say they lose, but they could take you 6 or 7 with the way they play their game.
Yeah, and that third quarter I thought was a good illustration of, because it felt like there were times in this game where both teams played physical and the officials kind of swallowed their whistles and let it go. And then there were other times there was some ticky-tack calls or it's like, really? And that third quarter, it felt like the Celtics never got into the rhythm of the game. They ended up getting outscored by 15 in the quarter. So, of course, it's tied going into the fourth. And that's why, like, when you look forward at this matchup, because they lost to Atlanta earlier in the year. That was a bad loss, but I'm not worried about Atlanta. I'm not worried about some, like, they lost to Cleveland in Cleveland, but that was a game that they didn't have Brown or White.
Right.
Like, I'm not, and Cleveland's good, don't get me wrong. But this Orlando team, again, over the last several years has given the Celtics problems, and I think that physicality is a big part of it. It's something, and look, if Tatum played last night, Celtics very well could have won.
Yeah.
And you look at some of the late-game decision-making, too, like, that Horford corner three with 34.1 seconds to go. If he makes that, we're probably sitting here talking about a win and no big deal. But it's like that was early in the shot clock, and maybe he wanted a two-for-one in case he missed, which is so fine.
That was my best guess on that.
Yeah.
It surprised me the ball ended up in his hands. But again, you're shorthanded. To try to get the shot off quickly, I guess that's the move you make.
And even that final Magic three, like, all you want to do there is not allow them to get a three off. Jaylen Brown kind of comes off the shooter, then tries to get back out there.
Yeah.
He doesn't get back out there in time. Boom, three, 108-104. Game's over, right? So it's... Again, not the end of it, but it was a frustrating loss, and that it was. This is a team that you could see in the postseason, that I think you will see in the postseason. One of the better teams in the East has historically given you problems, so you get out to that 15-point halftime lead, maybe make a little bit of a statement like, hey, we don't have Tatum, but we can play your style of physical game, and we can beat you. And the Magic, as shorthanded as they were, really outplayed the Celtics throughout the entire second half. I mean, I know that it was tied in the fourth or whatever, but the Celtics went into halftime with a 15-point lead. The physicality was fine in the first half, but to your point, maybe there was that wear-down factor a little bit there by the Magic. I mean, they're not going to stop fighting, and it's just, again, one of those things to kind of file away in the back of your mind come playoff time.
Yeah, no question. And also, and I think this is kind of a point that you were making in the second half, you get one shot to fall to kind of stop the run that was going on, we're also probably talking about a different game. Jaylen Brown had 35 points, but he shot 15 of 29 and one of seven from three. That's also an anomaly, I would say, especially the one for seven from three. You get Peyton Pritchard, one of five from three. Again, it was a bit
11
of a,
bench points in this game.
Right,
total.
Exactly. Right. So you get one of those shots to fall as Orlando's kind of building their momentum in the second half. I also think we're having a different conversation.
Yeah.
And it's
Porzingis, right? Like Porzingis, if you look at it in the service, 17 points.
Yeah.
13 of 14 from the free throw line,
oh
though.
My
like,
God.
He was 0 of 4 from 3, 2 of 10 from the field. So that's why, again, I know the Green Teamers get defensive. I still think they're the best team in the NBA, all that, whatever. It's just one of those frustrating losses, and it's a game that it felt like they didn't consistently match the physicality. And as you said, Mazzulla mentioned it a bunch of times post-game. Jaylen Brown mentioned it a bunch of times post-game. And it's something that when it gets down to it, like last year, the Pacers, you matched what they did. Like the Pacers, they run really well, for lack of a better term. They use great pace.
Yeah. And
the Celtics match that.
Yeah.
The Mavs, obviously the Celtics are better than they all played. This year, though, you play a team like Orlando in the playoffs. You play a team like Oklahoma City potentially in the finals. You're going to have to match physicality that maybe you weren't really forced to last year as much, just because the teams you played were different styles. Like maybe Cleveland last year in the second round, you had to match some physicality there, but they were shorthanded at the end of that series too. So that's something that I think the Celtics from now until April, that's something they need to work on going forward, is matching. It's just, I don't think they can't do it. It's just they haven't had a lot of opportunities to do it. Last night they did, and they failed.
Yeah, that's fair. And you also talked about the way that they rolled their lineup out. I think you're so good, and you win so often, that you do have the luxury to, say, tinker with your lineup and your rotation a little bit. When you know you're playing a team like Orlando, that's going to be more physical.
Do you have any concerns, though, about, because I think we're at a point now where their starting five from the finals last year, Porzingis, Holiday, Tatum, the true starting five, they've only played, I think, two games together and only finished one game together all year. I mean, is there, look, they're the defending champs. They're awesome, as we know, but at some point, even those guys need to get into a rhythm. I mean, do you have any concerns that those guys still were at a handful of games they've even played together this year?
I think you have to be a little concerned. I'm just concerned about Porzingis as a whole.
Yeah.
And
put him in bubble wrap.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know it's against the rules to load manage, or only so far you can do it, but you have to find a way to keep this guy useful. I wonder if at some point, for the sake of continuity and allowing this five-man unit to find whatever their championship-level form is going to be, is there a point where you finally give Peyton Pritchard the opportunity he deserves and make him a starter on this team, and you start to manage Porzingis' minutes as a player off the bench in certain situations? Maybe it's not every single game, but to your point about continuity, I worry about Porzingis' ability to hold up and maybe the ripple effect that could have on the rest of the group.
I'm okay if Porzingis plays 40 games this year, to be completely honest with you.
Yeah.
But I do think there needs to be a point, and maybe it won't be until late February, March, where these guys start playing 6, 7, 8, 10 straight games together, getting into a rhythm. Because I think that's going to matter. Maybe not in the first round of the playoffs, but that's if you get Orlando in the second round, that's going to matter.
Yeah.
Like, it really is going to matter. And then, of course, if you get Cleveland in the conference finals, it's going to matter then. It's something I would like to see. But Celtics, again, 108-104 loss. One of the most frustrating losses of the year, but good news. They play tomorrow against Philly, and they'll probably win by 10 on Christmas Day. Yep. We are going to talk a little bit more Celtics later. We have Bruins to get to. We have Red Sox to get to. But coming up next, Patriots lose in Buffalo, but dare we say moral victory? No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to say moral victory, but they lose a close game in Buffalo. Did that solidify Gerard Mayo's future in New England? Did that solidify some other things with the Patriots and their future going forward? But before we get to any of that, it is time to trend with Abington's finest, Zach Coe.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
Trending now brought to you by Harry Potter, the exhibition. The Bruins head into the NHL holiday break on a high note, getting a 4-1 victory over one of the best teams in the NHL, the Washington Capitals. Justin Brazeau, Elias Lindholm, Charlie Coyle, and Brad Marchand, your goal scorers for the Bees. They'll be off until Saturday when they head to Columbus to take on the Blue Jackets. Tough one for the Celtics last night. They fall to the Orlando Magic 108-104 at the final from Orlando. Jaylen Brown led the way for the Seas with 35 points after Jason Tatum was a late scratch from the game. Like John just said, they'll host the Philadelphia 76ers tomorrow evening at the TD Garden, tip-off set for 5 p.m. Patriots continue to prep for Saturday's matchup at Gillette with the Chargers. That one goes down Saturday afternoon, kickoff set for 1 p.m. Still waiting on an injury report for the Pats, but we'll have that as soon as they release it. NFL Week 17 kicks off tomorrow with the Chiefs traveling to Pittsburgh to take on the Steelers at 1. Then Lamar Jackson and the Ravens head to Houston for a matchup with the Texans. That one goes down at 4:30. Don't forget, you can hear Westwood One's coverage of both of those games right here on WEEI. Coverage starting at 12:30 tomorrow afternoon. The Red Sox continued to bolster their rotation yesterday. They reportedly signed Walker Buehler to a one-year $20 million deal. The former Dodger recorded the last out of the World Series. According to the Boston Globe's Alex Speer, the Sox now turn their attention to adding a right-handed bat to the rotation. Harry Potter, the exhibition, has just added dates in Boston. Come celebrate the filmmaking magic of Harry Potter in an unforgettable, interactive way. You won't want to miss it. Here through April 27th. Get your tickets before it's too late at harrypotterexhibition.com. My name is Zach Coe, and that's what's trending on WEEI and WEEI.com. More John Lyons and Dan Ball filling in for Jones and Keefe after this.
Ah, can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising?
People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience?
Visit stateofaudio.com to see Odyssey's State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative.
Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
Save us as a favorite on the Odyssey app and take Boston Sports Original everywhere you go.
You're listening to Jones and Keefe on WEEI.
Back here on WEEI, filling in for Jones and Keefe, I'm John Lyons alongside Dan Ball. Good Zach co-producing, Brian running the Twitch. And we are going to talk some Patriots this segment. There, I thought there was a really interesting discussion on Boston sports tonight, last night, that I want to kind of get to and go from there. But first, we do have one Celtics call on the line here I want to get to. Adam in Framingham, Celtics end of game, he wants to talk about. Adam, welcome in. What do you got for us?
What's up, guys? Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Real quick. So end of the game. Celtics do this a lot. And when it's Tatum who pushes it up and elevates for a shot or drives and kicks, I can live with it. End of the game last night, Celtics are down one. And I want to say there was like, 35, 36 seconds they came down, and they went 2-for-1 and got a quick corner contested three from Al. Missed, Orlando comes down, Kansas three, down 4, game over. And I thought that was a terrible possession. Like, there was no need to rush a 2-for-1 with an Al Horford contested corner three at the end of the game.
Yeah,
and Adam, that's where they missed Tatum.
Thanks for the call. I agree, right? That was definitely an instance they missed Tatum. I didn't love the shot there. I know they were going 2-for-1. Something interesting, too, Dan. Celtics defensive rating in the fourth quarter this year, 19th.
Really?
Fourth quarter, and you said off air, I think it's a fair point. A lot of blowouts that, you know, their main defensive guys, you know, Brown's not out there late in games.
Yeah,
White,
like I'm not trusting Xavier Tillman to keep my defensive rating up at the
end
of the game.
Maybe it caught up with them a little bit last time. I mean, they had a bad third quarter. They were better in the fourth, but still, Orlando got the three they needed to go up 108-104. The Celtics, when they were down by one, 105-104, they got the contested three from Al. So yeah, I agree with the call. I didn't love that shot. I understand the logic of the 2-for-1. Just didn't love the shot there.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been the guy I would even ask to take a contested three, let alone an open three with Al Horford. So, and on the defensive side, I'm going to preface this by saying this is a huge excuse to stay focused for an entire game, for an 82 game season. There are going to be lapses at certain points. That's not a good thing, but I think it's a certain part. You're winning a lot of games pretty handily by that point. And also, there are games where you're just going to lose focus. That's not a good thing, but I think those are two, I'd say those are two contributing factors.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like a lack of clutch. That wouldn't be what I'd point
to. Yeah, you wonder if that was an element last night, especially with the 15-point halftime lead. So
I think there's something to that.
So we do want to talk some Patriots here. We just wanted to sneak in that call. Thanks again, Adam. Patriots lose this game to Buffalo, 24-21. And I think it's one of those things where big picture, you look at it and you say, okay, they were 3 points away from a Buffalo team that could win the Super Bowl. Small picture, they made a lot of mistakes and they probably should have won. And there was an interesting discussion last night on Boston Sports Tonight. I think we have that quote now from Michael Hawley. Here it is.
Let's call it a refreshing, surprising loss. How about that? I mean, like, Buffalo had scored 90 points in the previous two games, including 48 against a team that some consider the best in the league in Detroit. That was just last week. Their last game, they scored 48 against Detroit. You slice that in half, they come up with 24, and really, DeMarcus Covington's beleaguered defense gave up 17 because you don't count the backwards pass that turned, you know, Drake May to Ramondre Stevenson. So I don't think anybody had the Patriots giving up 17 points to the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting way to kind of think about this game in that you big picture again. Your defense gave up 17 points to the Bills. You forced a Josh Allen interception in this game. You lose 24-21, but you're up 14-0 in this game. You have a huge fumble in the second half, which then the Bills take the lead 17-14. Your quarterback throws a bad red zone interception, which was actually in the end zone. And then that backwards pass fiasco. I don't even want to call it a fumble, an interception. It was a backwards pass fiasco.
Yeah.
Because that was, like, the backwards pass to me, Dan, I think was a microcosm of everything that's been wrong with their offense this year, and I'll tell you why. So first of all, I thought Alex Van Pelt had maybe his best game of the whole year in this game. He was really good throughout this game, especially early on, some of those screens to the tight ends and the backs to keep the Bills' pass rush off balance. Like, I thought he was really good in this game. I thought the Patriots' offensive line run-blocked maybe as well as they have all year, right? But you look at that play. So first of all, you're calling a swing pass screen inside your own 10-yard line. I don't love the call.
Yep.
Probably the biggest failure on the play belongs to your offensive line. DeMontre Jacobs whiffs on his cut block, which means Ramondre Stevenson has to run his route a little bit deeper than he probably should. Gerard Mayo mentioned that, I think, after the game or maybe the next morning.
Right.
But he runs that route a little bit deeper, and then Drake May either doesn't see the missed block or sees it and chooses to throw the backwards pass anyway. Either way, not good. Then Stevenson has it hit him in the hands, doesn't catch it, and of course it rolls to the end zone for a Bills touchdown. Like, it was just this multi-level failure. And you could tell me that, hey, it was more Jacobs, it was more Stevenson, but like all of those guys collectively played a part in that fiasco. And that's why, again, I look at this game and I say, big picture, hey, you're within 3 points of a great Bills team. But it's another one of those games, Dan, where they don't know how to win. Obviously, look, they've won three games this year. We know they stink. But they don't know how to win. They don't know how to overcome mistakes. And we saw it again on Sunday.
Yeah, there was no, at the time where championship-level teams put the pedal to the metal, it was, all right, everybody on our offense is going to start making mistakes at the exact same time. So you're right about that. The play calling all of a sudden, the play calling was volatile from start to finish. It was extremely aggressive in the first half, where you finally started to let Drake May open it up a little bit. You started to see the yards per attempt tick up and up and up and up as it seems like Van Pelt has finally accepted, all right, this kid's good. Let's let him throw the ball downfield and see if we can actually get a receiver who can catch a pass. So it started there. You also get the fake punt. Where did that come from?
It worked,
from?
By the way.
I know, but I where know. Did that come
I
from?
Know. That, what was annoying about that...
Deep it, in
so
your
first
own
of
territory.
All, the fake punt was a lot of fun. Like,
yeah,
that was cool.
It was great.
The frustrating part is you still have to punt like three plays later because,
right.
You know, you get to a point where... And I understood. I know a lot of people disagreed with them punting there, but I understood them punting there because at that point, enough time had come off the clock where maybe you forced Josh Allen to drive the whole field. And if he does, he does. But it worked out. He didn't drive the whole field.
Right.
No points were given up. Whereas if you turned it over on downs there, you know, whereas, and I know it sounds counterintuitive, but if you had turned it over on downs on the fake punt, chances are the Bills score quickly and you get the ball back. Whereas if you turned it over on downs following the fake punt, they probably use up the rest of that quarter and get points.
And I agree with your logic on that one, but that kind of adds to my overall issue, which is the play calling started aggressively. You were throwing the ball. Yep. The mix of plays, run, pass, whatever. The mix was strong. Then you get aggressive on the fake punt, and it works. And then you get, because that next situation was a 4th and 1, if I remember correctly.
It was 4th and short. I think it was
fourth and short. And now all of a sudden we're not going to stay aggressive when it's clearly working. So my issue wasn't necessarily that they went aggressive or not or whatever else. It's that all of a sudden everything changed. And there was no commitment to the philosophy that seemed to be working. So I'm right there with you in that I'd be frustrated at a level that I would imagine Patriots fans haven't been much this season, which is we were in a game with a good team where we were bringing the fight to the Bills and they were not responding well. They looked completely out of sorts and really unprepared for the level of aggression on offense that the Patriots were bringing. And you get into the locker room at halftime and you come back out. And it's completely different, and it's passive, and you're making mistakes, and you can't really get anything going again, and the Bills come roaring back because they're a championship-level football team. So the difference in beginning of game to end of game and the way that it was handled would just make me want to tear my hair out.
Yeah, and to me, the key sequence, right, is that early second-half sequence there. Because
yep.
The Bills are down 14-7 at halftime, and I thought that first Bills touchdown drive was the worst the Patriots defense played all day, and probably their only truly bad series of the day. I mean, James Cook, the 46-yard touchdown run. There was 5 plays to go 70 yards. They didn't look good. I thought the rest of the game, they played pretty well.
Yeah.
But that early second half, so the Bills come out, 9 plays, 68 yards for a touchdown. Again, I think that was more about this is a great Bills offense championship team. They went down, and they looked like the team that had scored 40 points in back-to-back weeks.
Yeah.
So I don't even – I'm not even as upset about the defense as that about that one. But they go down, they get the touchdown. How do the Patriots respond? 2 plays later, you get a Stevenson fumble. 7th time he's fumbled this year, the most by a running back in the NFL. Bills get a field goal. It's 17-14. Patriots then go down the field. They have a great long completion from May to Booty, in which Gibson had an awesome blitz pickup. You get into scoring territory, end zone interception.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that's a chance for you to, at a minimum, tie it up at 17. Then you force the Bills to punt, to the Patriots' defense credit, and then you have the backwards pass fiasco. So you look at the Patriots' first 3 possessions of the second half, fumble, interception, backwards pass fiasco. 3 straight turnovers, 2 of them led directly to points, 10-point difference, you lose the game by 3. Like, that's the thing. So big picture, yeah, you competed against a good team, but you're sitting here, if you just turn the ball over one of those times, I'm not even sitting here asking for no turnovers.
Yeah.
If you just have one of those turnovers, you probably win the game.
Probably.
And instead, you have all 3 in a row. You don't really recover from there. I know they scored the touchdown late, but even that took a long time. I mean, they had 1st and goal at the 1, and it took them, like, what, 4 more plays to score? There was another penalty in the end zone there.
Oh, yeah.
In that sequence. So, again, big picture, I thought it was as Holly called it, a refreshing loss, considering what we've seen. And I will say, from a competitive standpoint, we're going to get to this as it relates to Mayo later, much better than what you got against Arizona. But the frustrating thing is, like, at what point are you going to stop making these mistakes. I mentioned Stevenson, 7 fumbles this year. Drake May's thrown an interception in 7 straight games. Even little ones, like Marte Mapu has an interception in the end zone, comes out and gets tackled at the 1.
Right.
Like little things like the pre-snap penalties. Like, at this point, it's who they are, but you wonder, what is it going to take for them to not keep making these mistakes week after week?
Right, and what do you have to change after the end of the season to try to limit, if not completely negate them? The Drake May interception conversation is one that I'm willing to give a pass on, because this comparison that we heard all week last week was a little unfair, but there was a lot of Josh Allen to Drake May comparison because of the raw talent, the raw skills. And the thing with Josh Allen at the beginning of his career is he turned the ball over a ton, threw a lot of interceptions. And as you've seen this year, they moved on from Stephon Diggs. They move on from Gabe Davis. They kind of reworked the wide receivers around him. All of a sudden, magically, he doesn't throw picks anymore. So that's a change in play caller, a change in personnel, and the maturing of the quarterback naturally, and he's kind of worked his way out of it. I think there's a lot there with May that could happen the same way, because there's just so much raw talent there. So I'm willing to forgive those. Stevenson, at this point in his career, come on.
This has been an issue for essentially his whole career.
Right, and you signed him to an extension despite knowing that he had that issue, and now you're... I was looking at the contract during the break earlier this week, and you're tied to him for 2 more years of guaranteed money before there's an out in that deal. That's the end of the 2026 season before you can get rid of him and not have to eat the money. And you have a lot of cap space, but a lot of work to do. So you're not in a money-eating situation right now. So that's one. May, I have a feeling you can coach, and he's going to learn his way out of making those mistakes. A guy like Stevenson, where he's been in the league and it's getting worse as he goes along, that's a I need Elliott Wolf to be more aggressive and fix this problem kind of situation.
Yeah, and I think to your May point, like there have been several things he's gotten better at. Like remember earlier in the year he was holding the ball too long and there were several strip sacks. I think there was 3 in his first 4 games. There was the Houston one, his first ever game, but then the Tennessee one, he held the ball, you know, too long in that one. There was another one as well. He's gotten better about that over the last several weeks. Like, we haven't seen that really happening. I would say he's been better as far as setting protections and all that than he was when I watched him in training camp down at Gillette. Like, he's gotten better at those things. So hopefully with the interception stuff, he'll get better. And part of the interception numbers are you have the worst offensive line in the league, so not much protection.
Right.
And you have receivers that largely can't separate. Like, that touchdown pass to Kayshon Boutte, I think, was the best throw a Patriots quarterback has made since Tom Brady was here.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And even that, there wasn't a lot of separation there. Like, he had to fit it in.
He had to drop it into the basket.
And I think we're seeing that a lot. There's a lot of plays where guys are just not open. And some of that might be scheme. Some of that might be just guys that can't separate. So, again, as they improve some of the things around him, I could see those interception numbers going down. And that's the thing about Josh Allen, too. My biggest reservation of him going into this year was he turned the ball over too much. Even last year, he turned the ball over a lot.
It cost him an MVP last year. He turned it over so much.
And I think to that point, one of the reasons he could win the MVP this year, he's not turning the ball
over. That's right.
It's been a huge, huge difference. You're 100% right. We've got a couple calls here before we go to break. Let's go to Coach in New Hampshire, wants to talk Patriots. Coach, welcome in. What do you got for us?
Yeah, we could rehash that last game a lot, and that's great, but I'm just trying to think about improving the club for 2025. Here's the first thing I would do. The most desperate team right now in the draft is the Raiders. They need a quarterback badly, and they just went from, like, the top pick or the second pick down to 7th. I call the Raiders, if I'm Elliott Wolf, and I hope it's not Elliott Wolf, I call the Raiders, and I say, let's swap. You take our second pick. We'll take your 7th or 8th pick. Give us an additional 2 and throw in Jacoby Myers. And then what I do if I'm the Patriots, I now have the 7th pick, a couple in the 2nd round, and a couple in the 3rd because of the Judon trade. And I'm drafting 3 offensive linemen out of the 5. I really am. I'm committing to that position, no matter what happens in free agency. And lastly, guys, is there anybody on the current offensive line that you think moving forward – has made enough progress for us to be happy about besides Mike Onwenu? Thank you.
Coach, appreciate the call. Look, on that last point, I think Onwenu's going to be here. And I think Onwenu, if they stop bouncing him around everywhere, is a good offensive lineman. David Andrews will be back. But look, I love David Andrews. He's been a great Patriot. there's a chance next year could be his last year with the Patriots. There were some whispers about retirement last year. Now he had a season-ending injury, so that's not a long-term thing. I would also give Laydon Robinson a chance for another year. I think he's got potential as a rookie. And Caden Wallace, who's... Look, Caden Wallace played just under 2,300 snaps at Penn State. They were all at right tackle.
Right.
And then earlier this year, they had him at left tackle. They had him at guard. Like, and again, you need at least two, maybe three new starting offensive line. When I talk about Laydon Robinson and Caden Wallace, maybe one of them is a starter long term and the other's a swing tackle. You still need at least two other guys.
Right.
And to his point, I am 100% Dan, team trade down.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
I'm right there with you, and I know, well, first of all, you're not in a quarterback position, yeah, which is great.
You get a top three pick, trade down.
You can sucker a team in a bad quarterback class to come up and get that pick and sell them on Shedeur Sanders or Cam Ward, one of the two that's still up there, because between the Raiders and the Giants, and even depending on how they feel at the end of the season, how the two Johnson sons feel, the Jets.
Yeah, it's a Madden weight rating.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Is, you know, we'll see if they're desperate enough to come up, depending
what's
on what they do.
College football rating.
I had him in my dynasty on EA.
I hope
was great.
I hope the Patriots fans heard that and felt at least a little bit of
internal peace. Yeah, at least we're not
that
peace. Bad.
At least you're not. But to your point, I'm right there with you, because I think Travis Hunter is a very talented athlete. I don't know. First of all, I don't think he's going to stick as a two-way player in the NFL. I think he's going to end up being a corner
that will play some receiver.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
almost the Marcus Jones role,
right,
but
exactly.
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and as good as he is, you have so many roster issues that you need to fix. If you can get a group of picks that can help multiple positions, I'm right there with you on that.
Yeah, and I think, first of all, I'm 100% trade down, but they would need to get more than what the caller said. Like a second and a player. If I'm going to trade down from 2 to 7, I want another first or multiple seconds,
yeah,
or a second, third, fourth. Like, I'm getting at least three picks out of that. If I'm going from 2 to 7.
And you're giving a team their franchise quarterback in the
exactly,
process.
Exactly, right. So if I'm going from 2 to 7, I want obviously the 7 pick, but I want a second pick. I'd like another first round pick. And if I can't get the first round pick, another second, another third. Like, I want to walk away from that with three really valuable picks. Again, I know we're going to have 4 months consecutively to talk about this, but I'm going to be, as long as they're in the top three, even
yeah,
top four, I'm 100% in on them trading down. And you can get a really good left tackle at 9 or 10 or like Kelvin Banks or Will Campbell. One of them's going to be there at 8 or 9.
Right.
Like, no doubt in my mind. And I would take another tackle or another lineman, maybe early round 3, something like that. So, yeah, to the caller's point, I'd draft multiple offensive linemen, maybe sign one in free agency as well.
And there's precedent for this. I went back and looked at the Jared Goff draft, yep, trade just while you were talking there. He was the first overall, 4th round pick, 6th round pick for 2016 first, 2016 second, 2016 second, 2016 third, 2017 first, 2017 third. Now, I'm not sure if there's the talent that's as, you know, generational as Goff was, may or may not, yeah, have supposed
or
to
even
have
been. Or even the RG3 trade, like, that was
right,
huge, too. Yeah.
But again, that's 2 firsts, 2 seconds, and 2 thirds. So there's precedent if you're giving a team a quarterback in that slot to say, what you said, 2 firsts, another second, and maybe there's a mid-round pick you can throw in as well. Yeah. Something more like that.
I would agree. Let's before break, let's go to Tony in Worcester, because he wants to hit on something we're actually going to talk about coming up next. Tony, welcome in. What do you got for us?
Hey. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I agree with you guys about trading down and loading up on the line, and the last caller has it nailed, too. But I think we can't talk about Gerard Mayo anymore. He's not going anywhere. I don't know for certain, but I really think that Kraft has promised Mayo, and you know, Kraft's not going to go back on that. He's promised Mayo another shot. You know, he wasn't going to fire him this year. He's not going to fire him next year. Maybe after next year, if we repeat what happened this year. But that's another story. What we really need to do is get rid of Wolf before we hand the keys over to this draft to him. He is going to screw this up, guaranteed. He has no talent as far as picking football players. He doesn't understand the game. He's a number cruncher, and that's not working. If we need any more evidence than that, than this year, I don't know what we're looking at here. You know, it's got to be clear to everybody involved that Wolf doesn't know what he's doing.
Tony, thanks for the call. Elliot Wolf, not on Tony and Worcester's Christmas list, I would say the least. But he brings up a point that we're going to get to coming up next. Did this loss to the Bills solidify Jerod Mayo's future? We'll get to that and more coming up on WEEI.
Watch us, love us. Just follow WEEI on Twitch. Jones and Keefe
on WEEI.
Just trying to block out that noise. You know, I think it's a conversation about our coaching staff and stuff like that. I think it's some BS, to be quite honest. Coach Mayo, those guys, Coach Mayo's, we got, like I said, we got his back and he's coached us hard. He wants to win. We all want to win. We're all frustrated. AVP's been, I feel calling great the past weeks. We're just plays away, and I think we're building something good, building something that feels right here. And I'm proud to be, Patriot.
Christmas Eve edition of Jones and Keefe continues. I'm John Lyons alongside Dan Ball. And we started talking in the last break, Mayo's job security. Because, Dan, I felt like after that Arizona game, that was a red flag. Like, for them to come out of the bye week and play as poorly as they did, as uncompetitive as they were against Arizona, that to me opened the door for Jerod Mayo to potentially lose his job and other coaches as well. However, open the door is a lot different than saying, like, oh, I thought he was going to be gone. Like, I think it opened the door, though. The Buffalo game, I think, closes the door. So even the door was open a little bit after Arizona. I think this Bills game closed the door.
Okay. I can agree with that. And my issue also with the Arizona game wasn't necessarily the game itself. Yeah, they did play poorly, but that's nothing new. What started to raise the red flag for me was everything that happened after. I did a show on Sunday, and we went through the long list of mistakes that Jerod Mayo made in the 1 week that had happened between Arizona and Buffalo. The comments in the post game, you said it not, you said it I didn't, yeah. The walk back, and the Alex Van Pelt conversation, hadn't heard the quote, then he had heard the quote, then... I have Jerod Mayo's back, but we don't have each other's back. It's only that AVP had Mayo's back. So the chaos that Mayo brought upon himself and upon the team started to make me wonder, is he talking his way out of a job right now? Because I feel like the Crafts, knowing how much they supported Mayo, can deal with a year where they're struggling. But if they're struggling and they're becoming a clown show because of what their coach is saying, that was the thing that was going to kind of tip the balance for me.
Yeah, and that was the thing, because you look at the week leading up to it, the comment, and I know people might say, oh, who cares what he says in the media, but when you say, you said it, I didn't, to make your OC look bad,
yeah.
And that's after, remember, Crafts are on TV, Jonathan Kraft, if you're a lip reader, criticizing the play calling.
Yeah.
So after that, I'm like, man, the door is open for him to get, because I thought all along, for him to get fired after year one, it would have to be an Urban Meyer-level disaster.
Right.
And it has not been that. But that Arizona game in the aftermath was Urban Meyer-ish, if you will.
Because it was bleeding over from Mayo, between the lines, essentially.
Mayo wasn't in an Ohio bar, so he had that for him, right? Unlike
not
Urban
yet.
Meyer.
Yeah.
But it was Urban Meyer-ish. And then I thought, okay, you come out against Buffalo, a team that not only is a Super Bowl contender, I would say the best team you've played all year, and to look as good as you did, at least early, and be as competitive, I thought was a big mark in the ledger for him to keep his job. Because one of the things that's concerned me this year, Dan, they've lost a lot of games to bad teams. Like they have a lot. Like Tennessee,
yep,
is a really bad team. And let's just go through it for a second. The Jets have 4 wins. One of them against you.
Right.
Right? You look at the Bengals have 7 wins. You beat them, so that's a pretty good win right there. But then you get into Indy, 7 wins. One of them's against you. Jacksonville, 3 wins. One of them's against you. Tennessee, 3 wins. One of them's against you. Like, you're losing consistently to really bad teams. Even Arizona, I don't think they're that good. They dominated you.
Yeah.
San Fran, 6 wins. One of them's a blowout over you.
And half the roster and all their running backs are hurt. That line from Moneyball where it's like there's every team, then there's 50 feet of crap, and then there's us?
Yeah.
That's kind of what it's been against some
of those
teams.
Right, and that's why I say, like, they were losing a bunch of games to bad teams. It wasn't just that they were losing, but to teams that aren't that good, especially the Tennessee-Jacksonville Jets.
Yeah.
Like, those are, what do they have, combined 10 wins?
Right.
And they've beaten you three times?
And it's the same recipe every time. Mistakes and pre-snap penalties and non-discipline, and we fumble, then May throws an interception. Like, it's the same recipe over and over and over.
Yeah, and that's why I think this Buffalo loss was a check in the Mayo column to stay around, because it's the best team you've played all year, and you were competitive with him. But we're going to get into this more and more. Do you think Jerod Mayo deserves to stick around in New England next year? Do you think this loss against the Bills, despite it being a loss, saved his job? We got a couple of you lined up on the phone line. Stay there. We're going to get right to you after this break. Coming up next, more Jerod Mayo, New England Patriots talk here on WEEI.